people who are connected to the party are going to have maybe a little bit more sensitivity to making sure you end up with a candidate who can win.
A Facebook feud between a Sanders supporter and a superdelegate in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 31st. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, more problems with the beleaguered statewide student assessment.
It was going on and off, and that's just too disruptive to the school day.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know that Pick, Click, Give helps over 600 nonprofits across Alaska? Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $13 million to organizations benefiting everything from our youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive in Alaska. A small part of your PFD can make a big impact when you Pick, Click, Give. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation and Pick, Click, Give.
A Facebook confrontation between an Alaska Democratic Party stalwart and a young Bernie Sanders supporter has gone viral. Levi Younger of Eagle River sent a message to Juneau's Kim Metcalf via Facebook this week, trying to sway her from Hillary Clinton to Sanders. As APRN's Liz Ruskin explains, it taps into a feud the parties have been waging internally for a century.
The private Facebook exchange went something like this. Younger, a recent poli-sci graduate, says Sanders swept the Alaska caucuses, so why is it fair for Metcalf to spend one of Alaska's few delegate votes on Clinton? Metcalf is the state party's national committee woman. She tells Younger she's been in the Democratic trenches for 40 years and resents a party newbie telling her what to do. They kept it civil, barely. After Younger posted their conversation for the world to see, thousands of people shared it on social media and joined the fray, mostly on Sanders' side. Peter Levine, an associate dean of civics at Tufts University, says the debate illustrates clashing ideas about how a party should select its nominee. And Levine says it's understandable why the Sanders fans are frustrated.
They have in mind the model that the party is a vehicle for the public to express its will. It's a sort of first stage in the voting.
By that reasoning, the nomination should be by majority rule, and newcomers should have all the rights of established party officers. But Levine says historically, parties have seen themselves as associations that govern themselves and set their own agendas, and they like to reward their hardest workers.
And so on that model, it doesn't have to be majority rule, and then the parties probably want to have safeguards against being taken over by newcomers. So it's two different models, and they really have fought each other for more than 100 years in America.
Since the 1970s, the parties have largely followed the majority rule model. But at this year's Democratic National Convention, about 15% of the delegates will be superdelegates, like Metcalf, who won that status because of their position in the party. The term superdelegate dates to the 1980s, but it's a vestige of the strong party model. Superdelegates can choose whatever candidate they like, no matter how their state voted. Sure, it sounds undemocratic, but political scientist Norm Ornstein at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute says superdelegates were invented for a reason.
The party looks to get a broader public grassroots reaction, but it also wants to give at least some role for the people who are invested in the party, have worked in the party, are concerned about the broader elements of the party's well-being.
Superdelegates, typically chosen in a prior election, serve as a check on insurgencies and passions of the moment. Ornstein says they're long-timers, likely to understand the party's need to elect Democrats up and down the ticket.
It's also the case that people who are connected to the party are going to have maybe a little bit more sensitivity to making sure you end up with a candidate who can win.
Sanders is pursuing superdelegates, but Ornstein says it's no surprise that most of them are going for Clinton. She has done a lot of joint fundraising to help the party and other Democrats. Ornstein points out that Sanders, as a senator, rejected the party label, and these days is noncommittal about using his fundraising prowess beyond his own campaign.
He's got a lot of support. His issues are resonating with very substantial numbers of voters. He has raised a ton of money from small donors, all of that to his great credit. But, you know, his attachment to the party whose nomination he's seeking is a very, very tenuous one.
Ornstein says that doesn't play well to superdelegates. By the way, if you're wondering about Republican superdelegates, technically there aren't any. But many in the GOP establishment now wish there were, so they could thwart Donald Trump. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Former EPA official Phil North returned to the United States and is cooperating with a deposition in a lawsuit between the Pebble Partnership and the Environmental Protection Agency. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Phil North retired from the EPA in 2013 and left the country with his family not long after. Since then, he's emerged as a central figure in congressional hearings regarding EPA and with Pebble's lawsuits against the agency. Tom Collier is Pebble's CEO.
He was involved in drafting the petition that originated this veto process. He invited an environmental activist to help him draft the decision memo as to how they would go forward. He was involved in briefing the administrator on the issue. He was actually the person that designed the mine plan that the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment reviewed because we had not submitted a mine plan.
Collier says EPA's proposed preemptive restrictions to block Pebble's development have North's fingerprints on them dating back about a decade. Pebble uses information and emails obtained through the Freedom of Information Act to build that case, but several years of North's emails went missing after he says his hard drive crashed. EPA has dismissed Pebble's portrayal of North, calling him instead a low-level employee with limited influence on any decision-making. North arrived in Washington, D.C., apparently from Indonesia, in time for a deposition Wednesday and Thursday. His whereabouts had been difficult to ascertain over the past 2 years, and Collier didn't want to say how they tracked him down.
It's really not in our best interest to disclose all of the interesting little details about how we found him. I'm pleased that Mr. North is cooperating with the deposition, and I think he's going to say a lot of things that are going to be helpful to our position in this matter.
While Pebble's FACA lawsuit continues, a court-ordered injunction remains in place, blocking further action by EPA regarding the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. Most believe the matter will continue till the next administration is in place. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The state of Alaska has suspended a state-mandated test because of ongoing problems with the computer-based assessment. Students across Alaska started taking the online Alaska Measures of Progress on Tuesday. Testing that day was ended when a construction crew severed a fiber optic cable at the University of Kansas, where the vendor, Achievement and Assessment Institute, is based. Statewide, the assessment was on hold until Thursday morning, but districts again had problems after the vendor's system crashed several times, according to the Alaska Department of Education. Department spokesperson Eric Fry says they believed the problem had been fixed.
It was going on and off, and that's just too disruptive to the school day. You know, the students have to leave class and go to a room where the computers are, and they sit down to take the test, and if it's constantly being disrupted, then it becomes an enormous waste of time.
The department told school districts they would not resume the testing until the company can guarantee their system is fully functional. This particular statewide test is in its second year, developed for Alaska by the Kansas-based company under a $25 million contract. The Alaska Measures of Progress assessment will be replaced for next year. The Legislative Council meets tonight to decide what to do about the Anchorage Legislative Information Office. A judge recently ruled the state lease for the building is illegal because the state didn't open it up to competitive bidding. The council could decide tonight whether to buy the building or to move the office to a smaller space in the state-owned Atwood building. Council Chairman Kodiak Republican Senator Gary Stevens says the state will pay through July based on the terms of the invalidated lease. The council will meet in a private executive session. It's not clear if it will make a final decision tonight. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the challenges and risks of opening a retail cannabis shop.
I could say that we've invested over $50,000 already just preparing for this.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence, and by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
If you thought Alaska was pretty warm and dry this winter, you were right. In fact, it could come close to setting a record. KTOO's Matt Miller has this report.
Latest figures released by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Centers for Environmental Information show it was the second warmest winter in Alaska since they started keeping temperature records 90 years ago. For the Alaska Peninsula, Kodiak Island, and the North Gulf Coast, it was the absolute warmest winter. For other areas from northwest Alaska down to the southeast panhandle, it was within the top five warmest winters. Rick Toman, a climatologist with the National Weather Service in Fairbanks, points to the lowest statewide winter temperature as an example of how unusual and how persistent the warmth has been in Alaska. It was only minus 43 degrees Fahrenheit in Arctic Village around Christmas.
If this holds up, that would be by far the warmest Alaska minimum temperature for a whole winter. In the last century, the warmest has been 53 below.
Toman says for the entire state, winter temperatures were significantly above normal for 61 days out of the winter's 91 days. The overall Alaska snowpack is better than last year, but winter snowfall in areas like Anchorage was still below normal. So what's the cause of the warmer winter temperatures and the less precipitation in many Alaska regions this winter?
Why, Rick, has it been like this?
Toman says it's a combination of the warm water sea surface temperature anomaly in the Northeast Pacific known as the blob and one of the strongest instances of El Nino or equatorial ocean warming. Both events can affect the southern or eastern portion of the state. Low-bearing sea ice coverage, especially in Bristol Bay, can also affect climate in western Alaska.
At this point, the Arctic is clearly leading the rest of the world in overall climate change. The overall warming is greater.
John Walsh is chief scientist at the International Arctic Research Center located at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and co-author of an extensive report just released by the National Academy of Sciences. Walsh and his colleagues looked at recent research of extreme weather events and if it's possible such events could be attributed to climate change. Extreme weather events are defined as heat waves, droughts, and heavy precipitation. And Walsh says climate change may be enhancing the variability and shifting the extremes of such unusual weather events.
And there have been some studies that have shown that the temperature extremes are changing as you would expect. There are a lot more record highs and a lot fewer record low temperatures. Sort of a mixed bag of conclusions about precipitation.
But aside from the shift to more extreme temperatures in Alaska and the Arctic, Walsh says there's not yet a smoking gun or nothing that stands out when linking recent extreme events to climate change. Well, at least not yet. Walsh suggests that all it takes is for someone to do the research.
We really don't have anything to point to in the Arctic that stands out in terms of extreme events. Now, we do say that that's partly because not too many studies have been done on extreme events in the Arctic. So we're not ruling out some gold nuggets in there from the Arctic. But so far, they have not really surfaced in the scientific literature.
So what could a warm and dry winter mean for Alaska this spring and summer? Toman expects warmer than average temperatures across Alaska and northern Canada.
Given the state of the snowpack, which is in the interior, overall, pretty near normal. At this point, we would probably favor an earlier than average breakup, and so a reduced but not zero chance of significant ice jam flooding.
Toman says a low winter snowfall could add to the wildfire danger this summer, although this winter snowpack was still better than the previous years. He expects slightly above normal precipitation, which may be good, as long as it doesn't come with the thunderstorms that ignite those wildfires. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Hundreds of people across Alaska are trying to figure out how to sell pot. Just over a month ago, the state opened up the permit process for businesses hoping to grow, produce, and sell cannabis products, and applications continue to pour in. As part of an ongoing series, Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes spoke to one prospective businesswoman, Jane Stinson, of Enlighten Alaska LLC, to find out what it's like to apply.
When I show up at Stinson's South Anchorage house, I'm affectionately accosted by her two dogs.
Hi. That's Mason and that's Bailey.
Stinson shows me what would be a beautiful granite kitchen counter if it weren't buried under heaps of paper, page after page, of her application to open a retail cannabis shop.
It's where I do it all and have been doing it for about 9 months.
It is not a simple process, to say the least. Stinson pulls up the state's website for navigating the permit application, and it asks for information that officials with the state's Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, or AMCO, want to know as they weigh whether to grant business permits.
They ask a lot of questions about security, safety. I mean, they cover the entire gamut of any business that would go into retail or manufacturing. They are collecting all the data that they'll need to make a decision.
That data gets really, really specific. The state wants to see that plans are in place for how cannabis products are handled, all the way down to protocols for transporting the product itself. One of the biggest components is all the security services Stinson has to line up as she's figuring out a business plan.
So that's the interesting part, you know, that all these ancillary businesses and the ones who are actually going to be touching the plant are all trying to figure it out together. So there are a lot of businesses that are cropping up to support those needs.
Though the application is complicated, Stinson thinks it's fair and that the state's done a good job with it. So far, 177 cannabis applications have been formally initiated, with dozens more started for businesses stretching from Ketchikan all the way to Nome. The highest concentration, however, is in the retail and industrial zones within the Anchorage Bowl. 5 completed applications are under review by AMCO right now, all of them for grow operations between Fairbanks and Soldotna. The state is prioritizing permits for growers so they can get started producing legal cannabis for shops like Stinson's to sell a few months later. It's like authorizing farmers to plant their crops before letting any supermarkets open, which puts Stinson in the position for planning a retail business without really knowing the products that'll be on the shelves.
We are really anxious because we don't know. I mean, truly, we just have no idea what can be done out there, where the expertise is, who knows what, and who's going to produce the best product.
It's a lot of risk to shoulder with so many major factors still unknown. The fee to apply with the state is $1,000, and then if Enlighten Alaska is approved, it'll be another $5,000 for the permit itself. All of that pales in comparison to what Stinson and her partners have spent so far on things like legal fees and real estate.
I could say that we've invested over $50,000 already just preparing for this, if that gives you an idea of it's a lot.
This is just for state approval, by the way. Locally, the municipality of Anchorage will also need to approve of the business plan and sign off on it. The clerk's office says it won't start assessing applications until they're approved and passed along by AMCO, but Deputy Clerk Amanda Moser says the municipality's permit application will be basically a copy-and-paste version of the state's and won't require much additional work. Stinson made her first presentation to the Spinard Community Council last week during a special meeting.
And it went very well. It was very well received. It just gets easier every day. I mean, it really does, because you just talk about it more and more and people get more comfortable with it.
As Stinson and her business partners get ready for more community council meetings, she says she's optimistic they'll get through the technical hurdles. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The state's Board of Agriculture and Conservation heard public comments today on a new proposal that could keep Palmer's Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage open. The state-subsidized meat packing plant faces closure in June if the legislature does not approve funding for one more year. The BAC is considering privatization. Todd Pettit, a bison producer from Palmer and the co-owner of Denali Meat Company, says they're ready to offer a bid to operate the plant.
We are very enthusiastic of working with every farmer in the state in every industry that has to do with the production of meat and the multiplier effect of what raising livestock in this industry can do for this state. This isn't about one person running one set of animals through that plant. This is about statewide industry expanding.
The state has operated the plant since 1986. A large tractor fell into a river near the village of Tuntuntuliak. Now, local residents are concerned it could contaminate their water source. KYUK's Adrian Wagner has more.
Glenn Daniel, an AVCP Regional Housing Authority mechanic, was walking 50 feet behind a construction vehicle called an excavator on a frozen river when he saw it suddenly break through the ice. Daniel watched helplessly as Lee Wilson, his boss, and the driver of the rig jumped from the sinking excavator as it fell into the water.
Better not to lose life than the equipment. And I was really glad that everybody was safe.
Daniel, Wilson, and the pile driver, as the rig is sometimes called, were traveling downriver to the village of Koniganak after working on a housing development in Tuntuntuliak for AVCP Housing. The tractor, which can stand 30 feet tall, was the only thing damaged in the accident, spilling some of its oil into the river. No one has yet determined how much, but many Tuntuntuliak residents get their water directly from the river.
I had my son get water a few days ago, and when I went to I could taste the scent of diesel.
That's Tom Pavla, who lives in Tuntuntuliak and works for the traditional council there. Pavla says the council has posted warning signs around the village not to use contaminated water. Pavla also says the council has not been involved in the cleanup effort at the suggestion of the Coast Guard.
There is a plan in place to be able to extract it from the river.
That's Petty Officer Francis Castleton of the Coast Guard.
But it's likely not going to be able to happen until breakup.
Officer Castleton has advised the owner, Wilson, to wait until the ice has melted to fish out the pile driver, and says that the guard will not provide assistance in doing so. The guard also says the amount of oil leaked into the river is insignificant to harm residents, but they say that the situation could change if the gas tank of the vessel is further compromised. The owner, Lee Wilson, did not want to be recorded, but said he has taken responsibility for the accident and plans to remove the excavator, as advised by the Coast Guard. He says he has no clear timeline for that cleanup. AVCP Housing declined to interview for this story, and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation did not return our calls in time for it. In Bethel, I'm Adrian Wagner.
The Bureau of Land Management often manages land for oil and gas development, mineral extraction, or ranching. But as APRN's Josh Edge reports, a recent study by an outside group takes a look at other, less invasive economic benefits of the land.
Ken Raitt is the director of the U.S. Public Lands Program at the Pew Charitable Trusts.
For decades, BLM lands have been seen as treasure troves for energy developers, for the mining industry, and for the ranching community.
For Alaskans, oil and gas development is at the forefront of discussions involving Bureau of Land Management lands, specifically in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. But Raitt says a fiscal aspect that is less well documented is the economic impact of recreation, specifically quiet recreation or any activity that does not require an engine.
We really wanted to understand how much quiet recreation brings to the table in the larger picture of Western economies.
So Pew commissioned a new study to find the answers. Kristen Lee is with Echo Northwest, the company Pew commissioned to conduct the study. She says the study takes into account everything from how much time visitors are on BLM land and what they're doing while they're there, to how much money they're spending and how those dollars are redistributed into local economies.
That spending results as it
as it circulates throughout the economy in nearly 25,000 jobs, in $2.8 billion in economic output, in $1.5 billion in value added, and in nearly $800 million in personal income.
That's the nationwide view from data gathered in 2014. In Alaska, that breaks down to more than 450 jobs, $46.5 million in total economic output, and over $13 million in personal income generated from activities like dog mushing, fishing, picnicking, geocaching, and everything in between. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Anyone from land managers to off-road enthusiasts will now have access to high-grade digital maps for Alaska. The University of Alaska Fairbanks and the Department of Natural Resources partnered to produce the first high-resolution satellite image map of the state. KUAC's Robert Hannon has more.
Until now, Alaska was the only state in the nation lacking current, accurate, high-resolution maps. Since 2007, agencies, including UAF's Geophysical Institute, have recognized the need to correct that. Dane Broderson is a project manager with the Institute and part of the team that produced the new maps. He and his colleagues drew on satellite data collected from 2009 to 2013. The results are maps with 2.5 meter per pixel resolution. For the non-scientists, that just means more and clearer details.
At 2.5 meter pixels, you can start seeing houses and roads and trails, and even like a car. And that's a vast improvement over 15 meter pixels.
Broderson says it was critical to the project managers that the maps be freely available to the public online. He hopes funding is around to update the information every 3 to 5 years.
As massive fires happen and it changes the terrain, or as climate change modifies or new projects move forward, we need to be able to make sure that the base map that people look at is maintained.
The official project took some 5 years at a cost of $5 million. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Matt Miller in Juneau, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Zachariah Hughes and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Alan Lockyer in Palmer, Adrian Wagner in Bethel, and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I am Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Nearly 10,000 Alaskans have connected with the Salmon Project, sharing their passion for salmon all across this state. Join the growing family of people united by the love for this resource and the unique Alaskan ways of life. Visit salmonlife.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.